get started. I just want to start first by saying that this is the 24th of April, and I am at Leamington Spa.
Yeah.
Interviewing Dr.
Keith. Has it started now?
Yeah.
I was going to say, can we have a chat before we start?
Sure, if you want. Let me put it on pause here, or the pause button. We'll go ahead and return this to recording mode. So, as I was saying, Dr. Keith Jennings at Leamington Spa in the UK on April 24th. And as usual, we're going to start with where he came from, his childhood, his parents, and so on. So, you want to tell me a little bit about your parents?
Yes, well, my parents, neither attended anything but elementary school. Both left at about 14. My mother then went to work in a hosiery factory until she was married. My father was an apprentice at a private engineering company.
So this would have been in 19...
Well, they were born in 04 and 05, respectively.
So in the late teens, so early 20s.
Yeah, they were First World War children.
Ah.
At school, and then they got married about mid-20s.
Okay.
I was born in 32.
Did you have any siblings in your household?
Or? No, I'm the only child.
Okay, and so they had limited education, but how was their attitude towards your education?
Oh, very supportive. My father, as I say, started as an apprentice, worked his way up, and when he retired, he was works manager of one of the two branches of the company.
And which company was that?
It was Joseph Thompson Light Engineering Company in Sheffield.
Okay, so this was actually...
They made things like cutting wheels and abrasive things of that nature.
All right.
It's small engineering.
Very good. And so, but he had basically advanced to a pretty reasonable...
Yep. Yes, he was with the same company all his life.
Okay, something doesn't happen much today.
No. So.
That would have been about 40 years that he worked there.
Yes, he started, I suppose, fairly soon after school. He was certainly working there in the 30s because he was kept on during the Depression at a very low rate.
How did the Depression affect England? I know in America it was really a big deal.
Here. I mean, in the early 30s, a lot of unemployment.
Uh-huh.
But key people apparently were kept on at this company, and I think he said he was kept on at a retainer for like £2 a week.
Oh, right.
But things improved.
Well, better than nothing.
Once the war started, yeah.
So they did support you educationally? Why?
Yeah. Oh, very much so. My father was not particularly well off.
Mm-hmm.
He never bought his own house because he said he'd prefer to keep what money he had available for any emergencies.
Mm-hmm.
And the line with me essentially was, if I passed examinations which enabled me to go to higher education, he would support me until I reached my limit.
So. Okay. So examinations were at what age?
11, so-called 11 plus here.
Mm-hmm.
Elementary school, that is the 5 to 11, I was given a lot of encouragement. I was one of the brighter people in the class, so I usually found myself at least a year ahead on arithmetic, and I was encouraged to read widely.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, there was a local lending library, which in those days was extremely important because not a lot of us had many books at home.
Mm-hmm.
And the local lending library really was a great source of information. And it enabled you to expand your vocabulary and use of English and so forth.
So did you do any technical volumes in the library? Or
well, what happened was you went to the junior section to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and once you had shown that you could read well and had expanding interests, then the library staff would allow you to go into sections of the senior section.
Oh, okay.
And that's where I first began to read science books, popular science books.
This is popular science. That
you, yeah. You know. Oh, yes. I mean, I was still only 10 or 11 when I was doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So, I read about the solar system and things like this.
Mm-hmm. And so the exam came at...
Yes, the exam came at the age of 11. And in Sheffield at the time, if we passed the examination, we could go to a number of particular schools. And the better you did in the examination, the higher grade school you could go to. And I was fortunate. I was one of 25 selected to go to the best grammar school in Sheffield, King of the Seventh Grammar School, mm-hmm. which had an intake of 25 from Sheffield plus about another 5 from surrounding districts. Mm-hmm. And then 3 other classes, all of whom came up from the junior school. So to begin with, there were about 120 boys in, it's a boys only.
So it's a boy, okay, boys only school.
And we began in what was called the second form, although it was the first year there for us. Mm-hmm. And 2A, B and C were best, not so good, and rather less good. And 2D, which we were, was the new intake.
Ah, okay.
And at the end of the year, we were all sorted out according to ability. Mm-hmm. And what normally happened is that 2A and 2D together produced half and half of 3A. Mm. And so I got into that and mm-hmm. progressed through the school that way. So this was an extremely good school, very academic.
What was the name of the school?
King Edward the Seventh Grammar School.
King Edward the Seventh. And this was in Sheffield?
Yes.
That's north of here?
Yes, it's South Yorkshire. It's about 90 miles north of here.
Okay. Yes.
And King Edward the Seventh School was founded in 1905 by amalgamation of other schools. It began with the Sheffield Royal Grammar School, which I think began in 1604. And Wesley College founded about 1838. And we were actually in the Wesley College building. And the Sheffield Collegiate School as well came into it somewhere. I can't remember all the details. Mm-hmm. But it's still known as King Edward the Seventh School, but it's no longer a grammar school because of educational reorganization.
And that's when you first got exposed to science on an academic level? Or?
Yes. In the early years, one did more general science. And the emphasis in the school really was that the higher up in the pecking order you were academically, the more likely you were to be pushed towards the physical sciences rather than biological sciences.
Interesting.
So I did very little biology at school. After the age of 14... we had to choose which stream we wanted to go into, and so I chose the science side. Mm-hmm. There was classics, there was modern studies, economics and so forth, mm-hmm. and languages. But as a result, I dropped geography, history, biology at the age of 14. Mm-hmm. And my school certificate, which was taken at the age of 15, was taken in mathematics, chemistry, physics, English language, English literature, then French, German and Latin, which may sound a bit odd. But anybody wishing to go to Oxford in those days to read any subject had to have what was called a credit in Latin. Mm-hmm. And a credit was the second ranking, you get distinction, credit, pass. Mm-hmm. I got a pass, so I had to take it again. And then after that, at the age of 15, one went on into the lower and upper sixth. And there we did maths, physics and chemistry and scientific German plus current affairs in English to some extent. So really, one was streamlined into the physical sciences at a quite early age.
And then you were successful in this environment up to the graduation point, which would have been...
Yes. I took high school certificate, the last one, in fact, in 1950. Uh-huh. And then my parents went to see the headmaster about what I might do. And I can still remember, I had a cousin in the Nottinghamshire area, where my mother came from, who had a friend who was doing very well as a pharmacist. Mm-hmm. He had a couple of shops, you know, and was really doing very well economically. And this cousin of mine, who was a teacher, suggested I might follow the same route. So my parents went along to the headmaster, and we thought of Nottingham Pharmacy, and the headmaster had none of it. He said, no, you've got to aim much higher than that. Mm-hmm. You must aim for Oxford. Mm-hmm. So my parents, who had little experience of these things, of course, did as they were told. And I was put in for a scholarship in November 1950, which was known as the Hastings Scholarship. It was what's called a semi-closed scholarship. It was available to 30 schools in the north of England. It was established by the Lady Elizabeth Hastings, who, as we were told every year on Founders Day, left sundry lands and monies so that sons of poor northerners could proceed to a higher place of learning, the Queen's College, Oxford. And my year, the school did remarkably well. There were 7 scholarships awarded. 4 of them came to my school. So 2 of us did chemistry, and I forget, one did, I think, history, and I forget what the other one did. So that was late November, I was told that.
Before we go forward, was there anyone of your teachers in your schooling prior to going to Oxford that had a particular influence on you?
Yes. The chemistry master was quite personable. His street credibility was that he played cricket for Leicestershire Second 11, so he was regarded as quite with it, you know.
So he played cricket?
Yeah.
And what was the... with
Leicester? Leicestershire Second 11, so we were told. I mean, we had no means of checking up on that. But he very much told us that any exam, we sell yourself. Always sell yourself in examinations. And he taught you how to do well in examinations. I mean, you had to have the knowledge, but he taught you how to put it across. And chemistry was exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Physics, on the other hand, was taught by an elderly master who joined the school shortly after the First World War,
mm-hmm.
and whose physics was really late 19th century.
Mm.
He always referred to James Clerk Maxwell in full. Never Maxwell, always James Clerk Maxwell. And we were shown experiments by him of the electromagnetic age, where, you know, sort of post-Faraday, mm-hmm. but pre-quantum, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you an example, after I passed my scholarship examination in November, I was allowed as a special favour to work with the triode valve, which we had,
mm-hmm.
and to plot its characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
This compares with a rival school, where the father of my friends was a physics master, who built radio sets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we were not allowed to touch valves, because in case we broke them. And so physics was always a question of getting through the syllabus and making sure we did this and that. I learned quite a bit of my physics from library books, in fact.
Mm.
We had as a headmaster a chap called A.W. Barton, who wrote 1 or 2 physics textbooks, and of course we had to have his.
Mm-hmm.
I found somebody else's books rather more palatable, mm-hmm. and learnt from those, from the library again, the same one I was mentioning earlier. Mm-hmm.
Now, what was the name of your chemistry professor?
The chemistry teacher was a Mr. Hargreaves. I can't remember any more about him.
And I guess he would be like a kind of a young swing kind of guy.
I suppose in his 40s.
Compared to the physics
master. Was a physics master, Harry Redstone, retired more or less, I think, as I left school.
Mm-hmm. How do you spell his name?
Redstone, R-E-D-S-T-O-N-E.
Okay.
But he taught us a lot of physics, but it was always a job. He had to get through the syllabus, and he was worried we hadn't got this bit done, that bit done.
Didn't make it challenging or exciting or interesting.
The chemistry master, walked through it. Another good thing about the school was that we did an awful lot of practical work, which I think was extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, we would not be allowed to do some of it because of health and safety regulations.
Oh, yeah.
And I suspect because of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
But practical was very important. Anyway, having passed the examination, I was then thrust into the army because we had to do national service.
Mm.
And it was a rather peculiar time because the government had just decided that rather than do 18 months national service, we would have to do 24.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can imagine what effect that had on university intake.
Oh, yeah.
And as a result, the universities made a supplication which was allowed that if you had a place at a university, you could do 21 months, not 24. So having passed the examination in late November, I was able to start in January for a year the following October.
I see.
So I did 21 months national service.
So this would have been
1951.
51, and the national service consisted of?
I joined REME, the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers, REME. And rather to my father's disappointment, I refused to train as an officer.
Oh, okay.
Because one had an opportunity to train as a radio mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Royal Electronics and Mechanics.
Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers.
Electrical and
Mechanical Engineers.
Really. So, yeah, the radio would have been a lot more interesting.
And I had a stroke of really good luck by getting spots on my chest in August.
Uh-oh.
Because I was on a teleprinter course.
Uh-huh.
And I got these spots, and I went to the MO and said, "Oh, scarlet fever, you must go to Aldershot Isolation Hospital for 3 weeks," which I did. But my friends who were on the teleprinter course all had 3 weeks embarkation leave in December and found themselves in Korea in January.
Oh.
I, of course, having missed 3 weeks of the course, had to wait until the next course came along, and I was then put not on a teleprinter course, but on a mobile radio course, which was much more interesting.
Okay.
I learned all about valves and valve circuitry.
And
about 3 years before the invention of the transistor, much to my knowledge.
Okay. And the MO would be medical officer?
Yes, sorry.
Okay.
And so I finished my course in early 52.
So these red spots, they were basically, it was...
It was just a rash on my chest, that's all. I don't know what it was, but...
It wasn't really anything serious.
He thought it was scarlet fever. Whether it was or not, I don't know, but I was perfectly well.
Good.
And I avoided Korea as a result.
Yeah, right, that's interesting.
Which was
a little strange.
Useful.
Change your life.
Yeah. So I then spent the rest of my time installing radio sets in tanks, and checking the intercom and checking everything worked before the tanks were allowed to proceed off into the Western Desert at the time. We had a lot of sandy coloured tanks to put things into.
So there weren't any really hot wars going on at that time? Korea?
Korea was. So, I mean, when I was demobbed, I met people who had been in camps, say, 8 miles behind the front line, repairing sets and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I was quite glad to stay in Britain.
Oh, yes. So how big a force did Britain have in Korea, do you know?
Or? I can't remember now, I'm afraid. I was eventually allowed out in late September 52, and 2 weeks later I was in Oxford.
Okay, so this is a fairly prestigious move for you on the academic side, because that's a non-trivial place. And you were at Queen's College?
Queen's College, Oxford, yes.
Okay.
From 52 to 58.
And so what was good about that experience that you want to talk about?
Oh, a lot of things. My tutor was Jack Linnett, J.W. Linnett, who went on to become Vice Chancellor of Cambridge.
Can you spell that for me?
Jack, J.W., John Wilfred Linnett, LINNETT.
Okay.
And he was a very pleasant man, very understanding, very human.
Let me say tutor.
Tutor. Yes, the way Oxford worked in those days was that you were taught in two different ways. You were taught by lectures centrally, and you had lab classes centrally. But each college had... almost all colleges had a chemistry tutor, and the college would take perhaps 6, 8, 10 chemists per year, and the tutor would then give 1-hour tutorials per week usually to groups of two, possibly three. He'll begin by giving a random selection of students, and then he would rapidly sort them into ability levels.
Mm-hmm.
So I and another chap were fairly quickly put in as a pair, because we were, that's the most serious of the chemists. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had weekly sessions with him. He would set you an essay, he would read the essay, he would talk about it. He would ask you about how you're getting on. He would talk about specific examples of chemistry. And you could ask him one-to-one questions.
So there was basically a fairly focused type operation as you, the tutor, and you and this other fellow.
Yeah.
So that was.
And in the third year, you had individual tutorials.
Mm.
Now, he couldn't cover the whole of chemistry. He covered physical and inorganic chemistry. And another chap called R.M. Acheson, A-C-H-E-S-O-N, Maureen Acheson, gave us organic tutorials.
Okay.
He was he came, I think, towards the end of the first year, or maybe at the end of the first year.
So these guys do this as part of their...
Well, they're fellows of the college.
Okay.
And a college fellowship requires them to take part in running the college and teaching in the college. And they also have to have usual university appointments, otherwise they can't afford to live.
Yeah.
Where they do their research and do their lecturing.
So they really didn't get paid for the tutoring, but they had by being, they had other means of income.
Yes, they have to have really two employers, rather,
okay.
If you like. The university, where they do their research and their lecturing, and the college where they do their tutorial work and the administration running of the college and so forth.
And this is part of their obligation, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. So I progressed through the 3 years as an undergraduate, and in Oxford one takes one's finals after 3 years. And in those days, you also took practicals, which have now been abandoned. And your whole future depended on a very short period. I remember we took physical chemistry first, Thursday morning and afternoon, inorganic Friday morning and afternoon, organic Saturday morning and afternoon. That was it. 3 years' work. Examined in 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had a week off. And then you had 8-hour practical Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
And what's in the practical?
Well, you were asked to prepare something, perhaps, or carry out some measurements, or deduce.
Kind of like a lab side or that thing?
Yes, it was an 8-hour practical work where you set a problem. You might, for example, be asked to prepare a particular compound and then prepare derivatives of that compound which exemplified its properties.
Wow.
So one did one's best and hopefully got through. And
yeah, it's a bit of a challenge, it sounds like.
Now, after that, you disappeared for the summer and eventually got a letter from your tutor telling you how you'd got on.
Mm-hmm.
But of course you hadn't finished, because that merely let you through to what was called a BA Honours Unclassified.
Okay.
A BA notice. Everybody had right. A BA in Oxford.
Right. But I mean, all this education is focused on chemistry.
Yes. Yes. Oxford was unusual and very different from most universities, where we did 100% chemistry from day one.
Okay.
So you ended up knowing a lot of chemistry, hopefully.
Yeah.
But not a lot of other things.
Okay.
So at the end of that time, then, you had a good idea where you stood in the ranking, and your tutor would give you an idea. And I was told I had quite a good chance of a first, but I needed to polish things up a bit and so mm-hmm. forth. Then you did a fourth year of research work, called the Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
And the Part 2 you did working with a particular man. It was like the first year of a PhD in mm-hmm. most universities. So I elected to work, after some thought, with Jack Linnett, I nearly worked with Maureen Atchison. He was a very personable chap, but I decided physical was my area. And I worked on nitrogen atom reactions. A discharge tube produced active nitrogen, it was called in those days. And flowed this into a reaction vessel and emitted organic compounds. Then we got an atomic flame, and I was then able to look at the spectroscopy of the flame. And quite by chance, we discovered a new system.
Discovered what?
A new system.
Oh.
There were some bands at about 3290 angstroms, which we couldn't identify. And with our relatively limited equipment, medium quartz spectrograph was the best we could do, and that we had to borrow. All we could say was that it was either CN2 or C2N, but we could eliminate hydrogen because we tried deuterium and that's a change. And later on, I talked to Ramsey in Hertzberg's lab in NRC, and they took it up, and it was in fact symmetrical NCN.
This was, you say, Hertzberg's lab?
Yeah, Don Ramsey worked at NRC, and he was in general high-resolution spectroscopy lab there. And they followed it up and were able to identify it with, of course, very much better equipment than we have. Anyway, as a result of that, I wrote up my part two, had my oral exam, and managed to get a first, so I was quite pleased about that.
Yes, well, so what did they do in oral? Was that, how long was that? Was it a couple hours, or...?
No, not quite that long. Everybody gets an oral, no matter where they are in the list. So if you're right in the middle of the list, they, you know, go in and you have a 20-minute chat with them.
Okay.
What you're going to do and how you found the course and so on. In my case, it was probably about 40 minutes where I was asked to explain how a particular gauge worked and this sort of stuff. You know, and I remember being asked... what was the lightest shape of the ethylene molecule in its first electronically excited state? Now, what I did was this. I did that. See, that's that's the ground state, that's the first excited state. Everybody burst out laughing. I said, ah, a Linnet man. Because Jack Linnet was very well known for using his body to show you molecular structure. I don't know whether this is relevant to this, but if I can show you how the CO2 molecule vibrates.
Let me get my camera and a picture of the excited state of ethylene, because I think that's a little more doesn't come across on the tape recorder.
So well.
All right, so the first excited state would be like...
First electronically excited state of ethylene, I said it was that shape.
Okay, and then if you had a... If it wasn't excited, it would be...
It would be that shape.
Okay. Now you're talking to me about CO2.
These are both carbon atoms, you see.
You're right.
Sure. The hydrogen
atoms.
And he does that when he's excited.
Right. Okay.
Now, Jack Linnet used to work on CO2 vibrations, you see. And he would say, well, of course, the symmetrical stretch vibration, and then the, but the, much the best is the asymmetric stretch, which is this one.
I see.
Then I remember one tutorial, they said, I just read Ingold's paper. First excited state of acetylene, he said. It's this shape. HCCH.
I'm going to try that one more time. Now get over. What was that, the acetylene?
Yeah, acetylene. The first excited state was this shape.
Okay. Because you had the A?
CCH.
Ah, the C's and the E's.
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
So, as I say, Jack was well known
for his
internal rotations in the ethane molecule, like this, you see.
Yes.
And so that was my final question to Viva. I still remember it. And they all just burst out laughing. It's a good sign.
Well, I mean, it, but it conveys the information.
So that was the end of Oxford then. Then I went on to my DPhil. That was in the summer of 56, I got the first.
Okay.
And then 56 to 58, I carried on working with Jack Linnett.
Okay.
On what must be about the simplest possible reaction you can think of, which is H plus wall gives a half H2. Because our interest was in how different surfaces catalyze heterogeneous combination of hydrogen atoms.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that is the hydrogen-oxygen reaction at low pressures has an explosion limit which is surface-dependent, and you could correlate the explosion limit pressure with the surface activity, and our measurements were essentially a measurement of the surface activity directly. So that
you,
was...
So you were using some spectroscopic techniques for that? Or?
No. We use a diffusion technique. Imagine a discharge tube, and then a flow tube, and then at right angles, a tube down which the atoms could diffuse.
Okay.
Imagine then two gauges, we didn't discuss how they were, but two gauges like that. And in between, we would put a small tube which would coat with different surfaces.
Okay.
So we'd measure the atom concentration there, the atom concentration here.
Hmm.
And if the surface was not very reactive, of course, these two would not be very different.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were acid washed, that was what we found. If they were alkali washed, then the surface was pretty active and the concentration as they diffused fell quite rapidly.
Hmm.
So we were able to look at about 6 or 8 surfaces and correlate the activity with the low pressure explosion limit. So at this stage you might wonder where mass spectrometers starting. I'll tell you one, my first experience of mass spectrometry, when I was working on the active nitrogen work, did our new system have hydrogen in it? Well, the way to detect that is, of course, to switch hydrogen to deuterium. The simplest way to work with that, we decided, was N atoms into acetylene.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to make C2D2.
Mm-hmm.
That, as you can imagine, is extremely difficult. You get some calcium carbide and you pass D2O vapor backwards and forwards through it.
Mm-hmm.
You throw away the first lot because of the surface contamination, then collect the rest. Jack said, well, we'd better have it analysed, see how good it is. And he went on to the mass spec service, and I was delighted when they said it was 97.5% pure and 2.5% C2HD. So that was regarded as a success. Mm-hmm. I was quite enamoured of mass spectrometry, telling how good my synthetic chemistry was.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the nearest one got. And I'll come back to some aspect of that aspect of mass spectrometry later, I think.
So this was in the late 60s that you were doing this?
This was...
68?
No, 58.
Yeah. And so do you have any idea what kind of instrument that was that they...
It was an MS2.
MS2.
Okay. John Danby did it in the physical chemistry lab.
Danbury?
Danby, D-A-N-B-Y. John Danby.
Danby, okay. And so he was... This is still where you're at Oxford?
Yes. And he worked in the Hinchelwood group in the physical chemistry lab. Now, I'd been thinking of what to do with myself afterwards, and I'd applied to National Bureau of Standards to work with H.P. Broider.
Who was that? H.P.?
Broider, B-R-O-I-D-A, on atomic reactions. But, although I was perfectly normal, it took them about 6 months to decide I was not going to try and overthrow the United States government. And as a result, I got other offers. I applied also to the National Research Council, Ottawa, to work either with Fred Lossing, whom I'd come across and was quite interested in his work, or with...
L-O-S-S-I-N-G?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or with Bob Svetanovic. He's... C-V-E-T-A-N-O-V-I-C. R.J. Svetanovic.
Okay. This was in Canada?
Yes, National Research Council.
Okay.
Ottawa.
So, Was it all of these places that things were interested were in Canada? Breda?
No, Breda was a National Bureau of Standards, Washington.
Oh, okay.
And NBS.
Okay. When you say National Bureau of Standards, you mean the American?
Yeah, sorry.
NBS.
Yeah.
Which is now something else they call it.
Is it? Sorry about that.
It's the National Institute of Science and Technology.
Oh, NIST. Yes, that's NIST. Right. Of course, yes, I remember.
Okay.
Anyway, Lossing had experienced Mass Spectroscopy supply to him, so I didn't get to go with him. I went with Bob instead. I did 2 years of mercury-sensitized gas kinetics, which was very interesting. It was a very nice chap to work for, and I enjoyed my 2 years there.
This is Svetanovich.
Svetanovich. Yeah.
And he's in Canada.
Well, he was.
He was in Canada.
He won't be now.
Yeah. And so... The selection, what guided your choice there?
Really talking with Jack Linnett about what were good places to go to, good people to work with. And my interest at the time was still very much in gas kinetics.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, as I say, I enjoyed 2 years working with Bob as a photochemist.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, being at NRC, I was able to go to lectures by many eminent people, and Fred Lossing, Hertzberg, John Ramsey, various other people. And that was really quite a stimulating 2 years.
So the NRC was located
In Ottawa.
Ottawa.
There were two branches. I was in what was usually called the Annex. The original NRC building in central Ottawa, which was where most of the older laboratories were, and then the annex in Montreal Road, which was, about, say, 3 miles out of the city centre.
Very good. So
that was the Applied Chemistry Division.
Applied Chemistry. And this would have been in
58 to 60.
So this was it wasn't really a postdoc, was it?
Yes,
it could be a postdoc.
They had a very enlightened postdoctoral program with people from all over the world, which they cut back in the late '60s because I think it was too expensive. But one met people from various European countries, from Japan, and other parts of America. So it was quite a cosmopolitan group. And very high standards, I think. Anyway, then I had to get myself a job back in Britain. And I applied to one or two places. And I also had a look at staying in America. But I think for family reasons I wanted to come back home. I eventually was interviewed by George Porter, who was then Professor of Physical Chemistry at Sheffield. And I remember he said, well, he was going to be in New York at a particular time. Could I arrange to be around there? So, yes, so... I think we had lunch at the Waldorf Astoria. I was interviewed during this period and offered a job, which I took.
But this was a job back here?
Yes, it was an assistant lecturer, which is the lowest of the low. At the prodigious salary of £800 a year.
Oh, my.
But happily, there was a huge salary increase before I got here. We went up to £900 a year.
Great. Well, yeah, that's a, what is it, 12.5% or whatever.
And I had an overdraft within about 6 months.
So, when you say a lecturer, you were a lecturer at what institution?
At University of Sheffield.
University of Sheffield, okay.
Yeah. Back in my hometown, but that was purely fortuitous. I mean, I had offers from other places, but I thought this is the best long-term prospect.
And this was close to home, wasn't it?
Yes, very close to home, yes.
So you're the other thing.
But that was purely coincidental. It, I think, was the best offer. And it was a good department in those days, very good. So I came back to Sheffield and stayed there for 12 years.
So did your parents get a chance to enjoy your success and know that you?
Oh yes, yes. We saw them both weeks, and really, I got into mass spectrometry, I suppose, after about 2 years in Sheffield, 2 to 3 years. I wanted something to look at the products of my gas kinetics.
Mm-hmm.
And the department didn't have a mass spectrometer. In those days, you were encouraged to build your own GLCs and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I eventually managed to persuade them to buy me an MS-10.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with MS-10. Mass
spectrometer. Not really.
Well, it was a very simple machine.
Mm-hmm.
It was a voltage scanning, permanent magnet, 2-inch radius, with a mass range up to 100.
Mm.
And as sold, it would scan from mass 12 to mass 45 in 13.5 minutes.
30.5 minutes?
Yep. And then mass 40 to mass 100 in another 13.5 minutes.
Hmm. 13 or 30?
13. It had a potentiometer which went round 4 times an hour. So a 15-minute circle, and it was about 1.5 minutes when it wasn't connected, you see.
Mm.
So at one end it got mass 12, all the way around to mass 40, 45 rather. Then it would disconnect and it would go around again, or you'd change the range then. So this was my first mass spectrometer.
A really high-powered piece of equipment.
Yeah. So I promptly bought a motor which went around 15 times in an hour.
So what...
Cost clipping, I'm afraid.
What did that cost? I mean, it could have cost...
Well, it depends what you regarded as part of it. I mean, you could buy bits, you could buy a pump, you could buy a diffusion pump.
Mm-hmm.
You could bolt it onto a vacuum system, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it would probably be about £3,000 in
mm-hmm.
total.
Mm-hmm. So if I just might back up a little bit, so as he started an assistant lecturer, what are his responsibilities?
Well, you begin by having a modest lecturing load, usually with some of the more elementary classes,
okay,
plus one advanced course just to introduce you to the more senior students. And you get quite a lot of elementary practical classes too. I mean, we had something known as the inter-BSc class, which is the first year class for non-specialist chemists. People are doing physics or biology
mm-hmm.
or psychology mm-hmm. or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you look after them.
And at the same time, you were responsible for starting to develop a research program?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so this was the typical kind of starting professor type
activity. Yeah, and after the first year, promoted to lecturer. I mean, they have you an assistant the first year just to see if you're sensible.
Right. So it's kind of a stamp of approval.
Yes,
kind of a thing. So, but still, it's pretty low man on the pole as to be started to get the lecturer. I mean, your lecturer is still at the bottom of the star structure.
Mm, yeah. So then you slowly climb up increment by increment.
So how did you get money to do this stuff?
Well, the department would provide a modest amount, and you could apply to places like the Royal Society for a small amount. As an assistant lecturer, you probably couldn't get much from the research councils at that time. And indeed, I didn't need a lot, because I built my own apparatus. So I could glass blow, so I could make my own vacuum lines and so forth. And only the more complicated bits of glassware you got from your glass blower and
mm-hmm.
built them into your apparatus yourself. And provided you had a good rotary pump and a diffusion pump, that was okay. And then a mercury lamp.
Yes.
So it wasn't a very expensive way to start. So and I worked on the addition of hydrogen and oxygen atoms to fluorinated alkenes.
Mm-hmm.
I chose that because the fluorine would make quite a big change to the electron distribution of double bonds. And also, they would remain as gases, which, of course, chlorine might not have done. So this is why I needed a simple mass spectrometer. And it was interesting that I'd had fluorinated compounds, because that got me into mass spectrometry as such. One of the first things I did was to put vinyl fluoride, or fluoroethylene, into the mass spectrometer. That was a mass of 46. Well, you could just stretch the lower mass range to cover that.
Mm-hmm.
So you do mass 12 to 46. And you can imagine my horror when I saw the thing start 12, 13, then 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. I thought, what is this big trapezoidal bump on the baseline?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd read a bit about it, reflecting things and ions bouncing off bits of hardware in the tube. I thought, oh, it's probably a problem like that. So I put ethanol in, again, mass 46, ran the same sort of spectrum, beautifully flat baseline.
Mm-hmm.
So the trapezoidal bump was something to do with the vinyl fluoride.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was a metastable transition, which I'd not heard of at the time, so I read all about it. And it was due to the loss of HF by the molecular iron. About this time, John Bynum was talking about metastable transitions on the MS9.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to get involved with listening to him, reading about his work, and realizing I did the same thing on my extremely simple MS-10.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as it happens, the width of a metastable peak increases as 1 over the square root of the accelerating voltage.
Mm-hmm.
So in an MS-9, you typically worked with 8,000 volts. So the metastable peaks were pretty narrow. On the MS-10, I was scanning at around 300 volts. So instead of being a third of a mass unit wide, they were 3.5 mass units wide. And that's why I got such a huge thing.
Yeah.
So I put in a number of other fluoroalkenes and again got bumped in the right places. And so suddenly I found I was looking at broad metastable peaks.
Mm-hmm.
And this led me to read up in literature about a number of people's works, certainly Bynum's, and another chap whose name I can't remember now, who I think taught Jim Futrell.
I can't know who you're talking about, but I can't.
I can picture him, but I can't pull the name.
Pull the name up.
But, pardon?
It'll come.
Hmm. But he'd worked on doubly charged aromatics, and I thought of a nice little experiment with my MS-10, which you couldn't do on better mass spectrometers. If you put acetone and benzene in together, and you look at mass 15, you find you've got a doublet, because the acetone produces thermal CH3 plus ions, and they come out at the normal accelerating voltage. The benzene, because it fragments and releases 2.7 eV of energy, of which 2.2 is carried by the methyl ion, all your methyl ions in the source are lost, except those that are coming out through the slit. Well, they're coming out through the slit with 2.2 volts already of energy, so you need 2.2 volts less to bring them to focus.
Hmm.
And I was able to measure this with a meter.
And this is because of your accelerating voltage scan.
Yeah, and also because it was low.
Mm-hmm.
And you could then turn the electron volts down so that you stopped making doubly charged benzene ions, and sure enough, your doublet became a singlet. So this got me into looking at doubly charged ions. Mm-hmm. And about that time, the department decided it needed a proper mass spectrometer, so since I was the only person in the department to have any experience of mass spectrometry, I was put on a committee to help select one. And we had a couple of organic chemists, plus myself, go and have a look at various instruments before we bought the MS-9.
So how big was the department at this point?
I imagine it would be about 30 strong. I can't remember exactly, but of that order.
And this was be now we're getting to the 60s, early 60s?
Yes, we're talking now about 63.
Oh, okay.
Because our MS-9 was delivered in November 64. It was number 33, I remember.
So that was probably a big day in the...
Yes. And now one had to start getting involved really with other mass spectroscopies and learning a bit about what one could do and what the pros and cons of different instruments were and so forth. And this led to my joining a couple of groups. There were very similar names. There was the mass spectroscopy group, or mass spectrometry group, I'm not sure which, and the mass spectrometry discussion group.
Mm-hmm.
The latter were known as the lunatic fringe because they're the ones who took the sides of the instruments off, bored holes in it, added extra knobs, took the hacksaw to it and so forth, and generally advanced the technique because they modified instruments. And there was no society, you see.
But they were two separate groups.
Yeah, they were informal groups. I mean, John Bynum would host a meeting, say, at ICI Blakely, and maybe 20 or 30 would turn up. And at the time, I think the same was probably true in the States, manufacturers' user groups were perhaps the major source of meeting other mass spectroscopists.
Yes.
So one would go to the MS-9 user group in Manchester at what was initially Metropolitan Vickers before it became AEI, and you'd meet people there, of course, with the same instrument. So any modification they'd done, you could consider if you wanted to do, and vice versa. So the company gained by listening to what everybody else was doing with their instruments,
sure.
And they'd incorporate some. And you decide if you wanted to do it on your own.
Were these held at like at random times, or were they? Did they?
Were they what? Sorry.
At random times, or did they have a kind of regular?
Fairly regular, yeah. No. I think they had about one a year. The users, but the others might meet two or three times.
And so the users would be primarily the MS-9 or people that had equipment from this company, Metropolitan Vickers, or whatever it was at that time.
Yeah.
Do you have a rough idea of what the attendance was for those when they started out there?
Well, of the order of magnitude, something like 50.
Okay, so it was a pretty good size.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so were they all MS-9 users or people using their...
Well, there was the MS-12, which was like part of an MS-9.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The MS-9 without the electric sector.
Right. So there was just... It was people that using that level of instrumentation.
Yes, yes.
Either single double focusing instruments.
And so what one tended to get to know the technical people there, and when we come on to link this up and talk more about that. But you see, at that stage, that was really the only contact one had with other mass spectroscopists.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about that time that I was able to make really quite a leap forward in getting to know people, because we had in the department a chap called Brian Stevens, who was a photochemist.
Stevens?
Yeah, Brian Stevens. He went later to Florida. But he had a friend, Jean Dubois, who worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Jean?
Jean Dubois, D-U-B-O-I-S. And he was a photochemist at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and I met him when he came over, and I talked about the problems of, you know, getting to know other mass spectroscopists. And he said, well, we've got a group there, I could probably arrange for you to spend some time there. A chap called Jean Futrell worked there. And as a result, in the summer of 65, I went to work with Gene for about 3 months.
Okay, he was at Wright-Patterson, and he was working on his That's cross beam.
It's a big ARL tandem instrument.
Yeah, yeah. ARL.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aerospace Research Lab.
Yeah.
So I went to work on that for 3 months. And that was my introduction to the American scene, so to speak.
I see.
And I worked with Gene, and we produced a paper which went into JCAM Fizz. And Gene then wrote to me and said, well, why don't you come back next year and present the work at ASTM E14 meeting? Which I did. And that was the first of about, I suppose, 25 visits to such
meetings. Yeah, do you remember where it was held? Probably in Dallas, or...?
It might have been. It was the summer of 66.
Yeah, those were probably in Texas.
I think it was in Dallas, yeah.
Yeah, they had a couple of meetings in a row there. I guess they liked something about the place.
Yeah. So, I then met Tom Tiernan, who also worked with Gene.
Mm.
And shortly after, I'm afraid, Jean Dubois was killed in an air crash.
Mm.
I think a plane from... Cincinnati to their local airport didn't make it.
Mm. Mm.
So I knew his wife, and so they were just waiting at the airport for the plane to come, and it never turned up. So anyway, that introduced me to the Americans, and then I met a lot at the meetings, and as a result, whenever I went over, I tried to visit a number of laboratories, just to meet people, gain experience, see what they were doing, tell them about our work, and rapidly got into the habit of going to the States.
So,
most years.
Mm, yeah. So, would you plan to stay later than the meeting, or go earlier, so you'd have more opportunity to interact? Or
yes, I might go say a week before, or 2 weeks before.
Mm.
Probably have about a 3 week trip.
Oh, okay.
Ending with coming home after the meeting.
Sure. Because
I usually felt drained after that.
Yeah. Well, it gives you a chance to get your clock reset before you get into serious discussions with people. Yeah. So that's
I used to begin with going to Dayton and perhaps spending the weekend with Gene.
Okay.
Talk to a number of people I used to
check up on, see how things are progressing.
Yeah. Give them a seminar and find out what they were doing.
So what I understand he created this instrument. It was a cross beam machine, wasn't it?
They were cross beam machines. Yes, he.
So he was trying to get some ion chemistry going.
Yes, or select his reactants and products, and then look at the angular dependence of the products.
Okay.
I didn't work on that at all. I simply used his ARL as a normal double focusing machine.
Okay. Was that based on a commercial instrument, or was it all home built?
It was a CC21110, but with bits added. You
know. Yeah.
And I was looking at the relative intensities of what you might call normal ions made in the source, and products of metastable decompositions in the flight tube as a function of the internal energy of the ions produced. We were able to make the same ions from a variety of sources, knowing the heats of formation.
Mm-hmm.
And the higher the heat of formation, the more likely the ions were to decompose in the source. So your intensity ratio of metastables to source fell. But if you had just enough energy to make them, of course, you got many more metastables rather than source ones. So you could correlate internal energy with this ratio.
Mm. So you worked there, you were actually working there for 3 months.
Yeah.
And then you just kind of checked in after the...
And then I went back there... very often get a seminar.
Okay. Did you ever do anything, any more research when you stopped at right to Patterson?
Don't think so. No. Gene left to go to Delaware not too long afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So where's that got us to then? That's got us to late 60s, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I continued to work at Sheffield with the MS-9. And
now, were you recruiting students along the way? Or?
Oh, yes, I had quite a few students.
So, when did you really start picking up students?
My first student began in gas kinetics in 62, but I suppose I started with mass spectrometry about 66 or so.
Okay.
And we then come to something which you have asked me about, but we could, may as well deal with it now.
Oh, okay.
How do we get into ICR? Because of my interest in what you might call the time-dependent fragmentation of ions, looking at them in the first future region, the second future region of a double focusing instrument, I thought it would be nice if one could somehow slow them down and look at them as a function of time and what fraction were decomposing and vary the internal energy with which you made them and so forth. So it seemed to me that a time of flight instrument was quite good to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You had a nice long tube, and the idea I came up with was to have something like a little railway in this tube,
mm-hmm.
with some retarding grids and some accelerating grids,
mm-hmm.
so you could move them backwards and forwards down the tube and look at decompositions within a particular range,
mm-hmm.
as a function of the length of the tube, you see. So this went into SERC and whatever they were at the time, SRC, and I'd asked, I remember, for about £9,000 to buy a demonstration model time of flight instrument from Bendix.
Mm-hmm. SRC is?
Science Research Council. They're the major source of funding for pure research.
In the UK?
Yep. Mm-hmm. So nothing was heard for a while. I had a phone call saying, have you heard of the Cyrotron, the Varian Ion Cyclotron Resonance Instrument? So I said, no.
How do you spell it?
Cyrotron.
Cyrotron.
It was the first Varian commercial ICR instrument.
Yes, this was Llewellyn's design, I think.
Yeah, the Peter Llewellyn
was
selling, as it were.
So they called it a Cyrotron.
Cyrotron, yes.
It was an ICR box.
Yeah. Mm. I said, no, I hadn't heard of this. I said, well, it's been suggested that you can look at ions in an ICR instrument, you know, keep over the weekend if you want.
Mm-hmm.
Since you're interested in length of time, would you be interested in having one of these? So I said, well, I'd have to learn more about it and so on.
Yeah.
And it transpired that John Bynard had been to the States. He'd had my thing to referee. He'd seen this ICR instrument. As he said to me afterwards, I've seen so many Bendix time of flight instruments that don't work. You don't want to get involved with one of those.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a new instrument, and Britain ought to have one.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought you'd be the ideal guy to have one, so I suggested that you have this instead of a Bendix time of flight. So I said, that's fine. So anyway, SERC said, well, would I agree? I said, well, yes, all right, that's fine. So they said, well, you applied for 9,000. You wouldn't mind if we doubled your grant then to about 19,000. No, it's the first time it's ever happened to me.
No, so, I don't want the money.
So along came this ICR instrument.
And this would have been one of the earliest ones, I would imagine.
Well, yes, it was the first one in Britain at the time. And there was one in Bremen as well. And at the time, it was rather amusing because it was very much a California and Baldish-Filo-based technique,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the myth went around that anybody east of the Rockies needn't bother with it because they wouldn't know what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Jay Hennis, I remember, had one, and he felt a bit of an outsider. And Maurice Bercy at North Carolina, well, you could imagine what we felt like over here. You know?
Yeah.
You talked to Varian in Walton-on-Thames, and they knew less than you did about their machine.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, the Bible was produced, which was Jack Beecham's thesis.
Mm.
And we all had a copy of that, which worried us to some extent because it was so erudite. And of course, all the questions you ask about magnetic deflection instruments are irrelevant.
Exactly.
I remember talking to Peter Llewellyn saying, well, you know, what size slits are those? There aren't any. It's a 1-inch square hole. Things like this. And anyway, we got the ICR machine, and it wasn't really useful for looking at ion decays over a long period at all, so we got into ion molecule reactions instead. Since I'd worked on atomic and free radical reactions, that was a reasonable extension to what I wanted to do. And we had some ups and downs with the machine. I remember one of their servicemen came along and tried to unscrew something on the flange. Eventually it came apart, but he hadn't realised it was welded. It had to go back to the States to be repaired. And it was about that time that we got into touch with Mike Bowers, because we found that we were working on rather similar systems. He was working on ion molecule reactions of simple alkenes, and we were doing the same on fluoroalkenes. It was just an extension of my photochemistry work. And two of my students, a student and a postdoc, visited him one year when I couldn't go for some reason. I think my father was ill. And that began a long-standing association with Mike. So that's how I got into ICR and into ion molecule reactions. And
So how long did that? I mean, the machine wasn't good for what you wanted to do originally, but it was a good machine.
Oh yes, we did quite a bit of ion molecule work, and then in about 67, I got promotion from lecturer to reader, which is, I suppose, like an associate professor in the States.
Actually, it sounds like a step down, reader compared to lecturer, but I guess, you know, I mean, yeah. It's all in the way that you, terms are used.
But then 5 years later, I moved to Warwick to chair of chemistry here.
So you came in as the chair?
Yep. And I brought with me my ICR machine, and I just got a grant for an MS-50 mass spectrometer, which was eventually delivered here. It was very late in coming, but eventually it came.
So let me just hang loose here for a second. You had the MS-9.
Well, that was a departmental instrument.
That was a departmental instrument.
You see, in those days, you would not get an MS-9 for your own use. You had to make the case for the department.
Okay.
And consequently, all my work was done outside normal working hours.
Oh, so...
During the day, a technician would be running standard samples. He would knock off at 5:30. I would perhaps have an early meal, come in at 6 and stay till midnight.
So the instrument was there, but it was not, you had to get in line to use it. It was for research. You wanted to do research with it, then you were...
It was primarily a service instrument, which you could use at weekends and evenings, overnight.
Did you have any conflicts with the service guy that was working on it, because you would do something on the weekend that would...
No. The only conflict you had is if you wanted to modify it in such a manner that it might interfere with service work. I mean, certainly we did one or two modifications, which I think the service people were a little worried about. I had to assure them that it wouldn't affect their service work. I mean, we did quite a few modifications, but almost all of them could be undone, especially if they were electrical. You had a switch, you know, for... Jennings messing about, touch switch or not, as the case may be. And I remember the monitor slit quite well. We had an interesting thing with that. The monitor slit was 200 thou wide, that's right. And as a result, the energy band pass was quite large. Now, to get better shape of metastable peaks, what one needed was a smaller energy band pass.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to AEI, as they were then, could I have a variable monitor slip, please? They were very embarrassed, and I said, well, we are making one, but we've promised the first one to John Bynum. Mm-hmm. So you can't have it until he's got his.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, they said, you could do something else. You could take your monitor slit out and braze onto it a fixed, narrower monitor slit and leave it at that. So it wouldn't be variable. So we took it out and halved the slit, put it back in again. Service people were very worried, but it didn't make any difference to them at all. But I got better shapes for my metastable peak before I got my variable monitor slit.
So you didn't do a variable slit, but you had a smaller slit.
Yeah. And then another thing I did at the time, I remember reading some of Rosenstock's work about quasi-equilibrium theory and how they tried to model fragmentation. And one of the worries they always had was whether or not a particular decomposition was unimolecular or collision-induced. And if you had a very small peak of a metastable peak type, was it because your vacuum wasn't very good? I decided you could turn this round and say, well, if you're worried about collision-induced adding peaks, let's really go for it and put a lot of pressure in and add a lot of peaks. Now, how do you do that? What I did was to loosen a flange slightly and cause a leak. And that was how I did my first collision-induced work. But then I had a better idea. What one did every night was bake the electric sector plates to make them cleaner. And when you bake them, of course, all sorts of muck came off. So rather than having a leak, I just baked the electric sector plates. And whatever stuff came off the plates was my collision gas. So that pleased everybody. It cleaned up the instrument at the same time I could do my collision-induced decomposition. Because I argued at the time, not quite correctly, that when you're going at 8,000 electron volts, the ions didn't really mind what they hit, so long as they hit something.
So there was enough gunk in the instrument, so to speak, that you always said, well, what kind of...
Well, you didn't have to make the pressure very high.
I mean,
you normally worked at something like 1 times 10 to the minus 6 in the analyzer. Well, if you put it up to, say, 1 times 10 to the minus 5, then you got plenty of peaks. And it was when I went to Wright Patterson that Gene was very upset that I'd done this, you know, laughingly. He just spent about $10,000 having a beautiful gas system set up with taps and everything so he could control how much gas he put in and what sort of gas he put in. So all you have to do is bend the instrument, Gene, and you know, muck comes off and you can look at the decomposition. So again, that's how I started my collision-induced decomposition work.
So you were able to do this work at Sheffield in basically working off hours.
Yeah.
And then eventually you did get the ICR machine while you were at Sheffield as well. Yes.
And then because...
Yours, though. I mean,
yes.
So you'd have to...
And then because I'd done all this work with metastables and collision-induced decomposition work, I was eventually able to get my own instrument, which is the one that was installed at Warwick shortly after I got here.
Okay. So,
and that was used for a wide variety of things.
When you left Sheffield, you had reached beyond reader.
Well, yeah, I was reader in Sheffield for 5 years, and then became professor here.
Okay, so, and chair as well.
Well, yeah, that's the same thing here.
Okay, okay.
So, I suppose at the time I was Professor of Physical Chemistry. We eventually just called it Professor of Chemistry.
I see.
So, from 72 onwards until 97, I was here in chemistry.
So that's like 25 years.
Hmm.
Okay, well, I'm wondering, this is a good spot to halt for today, and then I can find my new home. I think actually I have the information. It's I left it in the car because it was.
Well, I can take
with that. With my map, so I'm not totally an idiot.
So we'll go ahead and turn this guy off for now.